Brock. He has spent the last year and a half in prison. We'll speak with his friend and a community activist, as well as Voices in the Wilderness founder Kathy Kelly. Then we take a look at a new study on racial disparities in healthcare.
In our study, we found that black patients and white patients go largely to different primary care physicians, and those physicians don't appear to be able to provide the same quality care to those two groups of patients.
We'll speak with the author of that study, as well as a doctor representing African-American physicians. And from healthcare to education, a new study buried by the Bush administration finds that children attending charter schools score lower on standardized tests than students at regular public schools. We'll host a debate on charter schools and the No Child Left Behind Act. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman. Overnight, the U.S. pounded the holy city of Najaf in the heaviest bombardment in the past 2 weeks. But the standoff continues. Yesterday, the unelected Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi issued a final warning to the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr to leave the holy Imam Ali shrine and disarm his militia. Backers of Sadr are sending mixed messages from the holy shrine where they are based. Some reports indicate that Sadr is refusing to stop fighting. Others indicate he is prepared to hand over control of the shrine to other Shiite religious leaders. Yesterday, backers of Sadr attacked a Najaf police station with mortar rounds, killing 7 and injuring 35. In Baghdad, a mortar round hit the former Republican palace, which now houses most of the U.S. embassy staff. Fighting also erupted in Sadr City, leaving at least 5 Iraqis dead. And the U.S. bombed the Sunni city of Fallujah, killing at least 2 people. Yesterday, Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy revealed that his name recently appeared on the federal government's secret no-fly list, and that earlier this year he was stopped and questioned at 5 different airports. And it appears every Kennedy in the country who had the first initial T may have been stopped. The San Francisco Chronicle reported that the government had determined T. Kennedy had been used as an alias by a terrorist suspect. An article in Britain's leading medical journal, Lancet, alleges that that U.S. military physicians were complicit in the abuse that took place in Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. According to the article, doctors routinely attributed detainee deaths on death certificates to natural causes when the deaths were the result of torture. The article also alleges that a psychiatrist helped, quote, design, approve, and monitor interrogations at Abu Ghraib. Bob Herbert of the New York Times is reporting that the Florida Department of Law Enforcement recently sent armed state troopers into the home of dozens of elderly African-American voters to question them about an investigation into election fraud. The Florida Voters League reported the investigation has sent chilling messages to African-American voters to stay away from the polls in November. Senator John Kerry accused the Bush campaign of setting up a front group to attack his military record in Vietnam. Most of the attacks have come from a group of veterans called the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, which formed after Kerry received the Democratic nomination. The Austin Statesman has revealed the group was organized by a Republican PR specialist from Houston named Mary Spaeth. Spaeth formerly worked as a PR consultant to Kenneth Starr during his investigation of President Clinton. Her late husband, Tex Lazar, was Bush's running mate for the governor's seat in Texas in 1994. Kerry said yesterday of Bush, quote, "If he wants to have a debate about our service in Vietnam, here is my answer. Bring it on." And this news from the Olympics and Greece. Sports Illustrated is reporting that the Iraq national soccer team is calling on President Bush to stop running campaign ads using the team. In one ad, a narrator states, quote, "At this Olympics, there will be 2 more free nations and 2 fewer terrorist regimes." The soccer team's coach said, quote, "My problems are not with the American people. They are with what America has done in Iraq. Destroy everything. The American army has killed so many people in Iraq. What is freedom when I go to the national stadium and there are shootings on the road?"
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman. On February 26, 2003, 3 weeks before the U.S. invaded Iraq, an Iraqi-American in Syracuse was pulled over. He was arrested, and he has spent the last 18 months in jail after being denied bail six times. He faces nearly 300 years in prison, plus millions of dollars in fines. On the day of his arrest, Attorney General Ashcroft connected the forthcoming military attack on Iraq with the fight at home against those who back Saddam Hussein by sending money to Iraq. The press soon connected this arrested Iraqi-American to Saddam Hussein and terrorist organizations. The man faces nearly 300 years in prison and a $14 million fine for illegally sending money to Iraq after the first Gulf War and for multiple counts of money laundering. Bail has been denied six times. Dr. Rafil Dafir did what many organizations and corporations did, violated economic sanctions against Iraq. He is believed to be the only U.S. citizen to be held in prison for violating the sanctions, and he still has not been convicted of anything. To his supporters, this is the story of a leader in the Islamic community who started a charity to help the people of Iraq suffering under the twin terror of Saddam Hussein and the U.S.-backed sanctions. The case of Dr. Dafir centers on a charity he founded called Help the Needy. Despite the innocent name, the government alleges Dafir illegally raised millions of dollars and violated U.S. sanctions by sending $160,000 to Iraq. Connected to this, he was charged with 12 counts of money laundering. 3 weeks ago, his attorney filed a motion to dismiss as he accused the U.S. government of selectively prosecuting Dafir by singling him out because of his race, religion, and cultural background. In one of his few interviews from prison, Dafir told the New Standard, quote, "This is part of a campaign against Muslims in America." In Syracuse, community activists have begun a Free Rafil Dafir campaign, and they are considering bringing their protest to the streets of New York later this month during the Republican National Convention. We're joined now on the phone by Mohammed Carter, friend and supporter of Dr. Rafil Dafir. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Could you tell us a little bit about the case and who Rafil Dafir is in the community there?
Dr. Dafir came to the United States about 30 years ago. He was a medical student and he studied here. Then he studied in Michigan. He moved to Syracuse towards the end of the 80s, the end of the 70s, I'm sorry. And he was one of the people who started the Islamic Society of Central New York, which is the local mosque in Syracuse. He was the president for about 10 years. Then he left the mosque. The case, specifically the case, was related to the work of Dr. Dafir that he did after the sanctions that started after the first Gulf War. And he saw the people suffering in his native country. And he started to say that he has to do something about it. He started to send humanitarian aid, food supplies, to his own people in Iraq. And that continued on for a number of years.
Now you meet with him regularly while he's incarcerated. What is his response to these charges?
His response that he's completely innocent of all the charges that he's being charged. Of course, the government charged him of violating the sanctions. He was charged with Medicare fraud. After the initial charge, he later on was charged with tax evasion. And all of these charges, he maintained his complete innocence of it.
Now, I understand that after his arrest in Syracuse, that there was questioning of various people in the Muslim community there. Could you talk about that and the impact on the overall community in Syracuse?
On the day of the arrest, on February 26th, many people in the community, a lot of people who mostly donated to the charity, were questioned. They got visits from the FBI between 6 and 9 in the morning in their homes to question them about what they know about the charity. Supposedly, the questioning is related to the charity. And some of the Muslims and non-Muslims were asked also about the charity and whether they know personally the people or whether they know where their money is going. And the questioning, the line of questioning, was very intrusive. It started to get into more than what you know about the charity. It got into your religion. Are you a Muslim? How long you've been a Muslim? How many times you go to the mosque? It started to get into personal things that no one should be subjected to. We estimate that around 150 people, 150 families were visited by various agencies, by the FBI, the INS, the IRS, the local police, many organizations, many law enforcement agencies were in on this. It's not just in Syracuse, it was in different places also around the country, in Oklahoma, in Virginia, in Michigan, in different places, that many people who donated to the charity got questions.
We're also joined on the phone by Matisse Senner, a Syracuse community activist who has launched a campaign to free Dr. Dafir. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me on the show.
Could you tell us a little bit about your campaign, how it developed, and again, the importance of Dr. Dafir in the community there in Syracuse?
Well, it's interesting is that on February 26th, when Dr. Dafir was arrested, the war with Iraq was about to begin. There was a lot of fear within the Muslim community in the post 9/11 period, and when he was arrested, it was mass hysteria. The imam at the mosque said it was one of the worst days to be a Muslim. It was nonstop TV coverage of Dr. Dafir's home, he in handcuffs being led away, ticker tapes and news break announcements. It was unbelievable, and there was just such a climate of fear, and there was no mention of the fact that 150 families had been interrogated. That following Thursday, the next day, there was the interreligious council that met, and thanks to the efforts of one reporter of our local paper, Renee Gadowa, and the testimony there, we heard from religious folks what happened. She posted it in our paper, and we got word out about what really began to happen. That weekend, during my meditation, I just felt called to help Dr. Dafir, and I had been going to the mosque on and off for the last year or two. I attend various services for various religions and try to get an effort together to help Dr. Dafir. But in those early days, there was such fear that it was virtually impossible to get people to support him, and it was very difficult. In May, we had a witness at one of the churches, and we did it for the Muslim community, and we had great attendance. Someone from CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, came up, and we had a successful event, and that began our efforts on his behalf.
Let me ask you, when at the time of the arrest, and Dr. DeFeer, along with about a handful of other people connected to charities around the country, were indicted, the Attorney General John Ashcroft himself said, as President Bush leads an international coalition to end Saddam Hussein's tyranny and support for terror, those who covertly seek to channel money into Iraq under the guise of charitable work will be caught and prosecuted. So Attorney General Ashcroft was clearly referring to Dr. DeFeer and others who were arrested at the time. Yet the government at this point is alleging no real connection at all to terrorism, is it?
Yeah, there's no connection to terrorism, but that terrorism card has always been there. The specter of terrorism is always there. It's either implied in some backdoor article to some paper or something, and it's what, you know, many in the media would like to talk about. It's newsworthy. So the government is always trying to taint him as a terrorist. And in fact, you know, we really didn't change that until February. A year later, we began to get people to change their mind about him. But just as recently as I guess, early August, 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, Governor George Pataki commented about the arrest of two Albany Muslims, and said that, you know, this was part of the terrorist connection that includes Lackawanna, the Lackawanna Six, and the money laundering operation in Syracuse. Again, smearing Dr. DeFeer as a terrorist. And
we'd like to go to a clip of that Pataki press conference right now.
Okay.
We've seen in Lackawanna, with the arrest of the Lackawanna Six terrorist supporters living among us, we saw with the arrest in Syracuse of money laundering efforts to help terrorist organizations. And today we see here, again, in the Capital Region, those among us who seek to help terrorists to conduct horrible acts against the people of America and against our freedom. So
what impact do statements like that of Governor Pataki and of Attorney General Ashcroft have in the Syracuse community in terms of being able to get the facts of what guilt, if any, Dr. DeFeer has?
It smears him. I mean, it just creates within the potential jury pool this innuendo that there's something wrong with this man, that he's guilty of terrorism, that we don't know all the cases, you know, don't know all the circumstances, I should say, behind him. And it's a terrible blow to him, you know. And we did get some positive press out of that, and that was that our Syracuse paper, in their lead editorial on Sunday, August 8th, in an article called Fear and DeFeer, just slammed Pataki and just said it only confirms what his supporters have been saying along, that it's selective prosecution, that and he's a political victim. He is a political victim. And because of Pataki's comments, as you mentioned, we are looking at potential actions to raise awareness about Dr. DeFeer and to, you know, chide Governor Pataki. We don't know whether we'll do that at the state fair up here or possibly even hold some sort of action on Thursday, September 2nd, when Governor Pataki introduces President Bush at the Republican National Convention. So that's where we're at right now with that.
We're speaking with Matisse Senner, who is a Syracuse community activist who has launched a campaign to free Dr. DeFeer, and we're also with Mohammed Carter, friend and supporter of Dr. Rafael DeFeer. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking also with Kathy Kelly, a founder of Voices in the Wilderness, about this case. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman, and we're talking now about the case of Dr. Rafael Dafir, a Syracuse doctor who has spent the last 18 months in prison. The government initially connected him to terrorism, but charged him with money laundering and violating sanctions in relationship to a charity that he was operating in Syracuse. We're joined now by Kathy Kelly, founder of Voices in the Wilderness. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kathy.
Good morning, Juan. Thank you, and good morning to Mattis and to Muhammad.
Yes, you have your group also has openly violated the sanctions against Iraq during the time of Saddam Hussein, as have many companies in the United States as well. Could you talk about how often people are prosecuted on this?
Well, it certainly seems that both Mattis and Muhammad are showing us not to be guided by fear, but rather by principle in regard to this issue. Voices in the Wilderness wanted to dramatize a challenge to the economic sanctions. And so, yes, we carried medicines and medical relief supplies over to Iraq, but more importantly, Juan, every time we came back with the stories about families that were undergoing grinding, crushing poverty. They didn't have enough to feed their families because they were jobless. The sanctions created situations of terrible suffering and misery in hospitals and clinics and amongst homes all across Iraq. Now, can you imagine those families calling their wealthy loved ones in the United States, communicating that they were desperate, and the loved ones saying to them, well, there's really not too much that we can do from our end over here. Dr. Dafir started a foundation called Help the Needy. It was clear that the Iraqi government didn't care about the poorest of the poor there. It was clear that the American government didn't care. And so he took personal responsibility, I would imagine, to practice a special tenet of many religions, the works of mercy, toward his own family. And so who gets prosecuted? Voices in the Wilderness couldn't have been more demonstrative of our intent to break those sanctions. We'd go down to U.S. attorneys in our own cities, in Chicago and Seattle, and say, we just want you to know we broke the law again. It's my 23rd trip, my 24th trip. And why was Dr. Dafir selected out? Why has so much intimidation and fear been imposed on the Muslim community? You know, just yesterday, Condoleezza Rice gave a speech in which she said that the Bush administration wants to reach out to Muslims as a crucial part of the fight against terrorism. Well, I think it'd be great if they'd reach out to the Muslims in Syracuse, New York, and say, we're sorry. We're sorry that you've been intimidated and that one of your community leaders has been jailed for 18 months. And we better want to understand why he formed a foundation called Help the Needy. Who were those needy people? And, you know, I think that Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney, when it's not even their own relatives, when sometimes it's just their corporate executive friends get into trouble, they want to extend the hand of friendship and help them out. And often I think, you know, they find ways to do that, and maybe that's not always legitimate either. So there's plenty of room for more empathy and understanding.
Mohammed Carter, a friend and supporter of Dr. Rafael Dafir, he hasn't even been granted bail. The government has refused requests for bail. Your response to that and to the impact that that has on the community, on the Muslim community in Syracuse?
The bail was denied many times. And the premise of the government is that we are close to the Canadian border, and he can just take a car and go across the borders, and because there is a lax on the borders, nobody will know that he left the country. Or he can take a boat across the lake, and or walk on when it's snow. It was mentioned ridiculously as it is when the lake is frozen. Then he might walk across the lake, and all of these accusations. They never said that he is a risk to the community, but he said that he is a flight risk because he knows lots of people in different countries that we have no extradition treaties with, and he can just flee the country. A man of his stature, and he will never do this. And for us as a Muslim community, we know Dr. Dafir. He's been in the community for more than 20 years. He's an oncologist. He saves life. That's his job. His job is to save lives here in this country. And he helped a lot of people in the community here. He gave student loans. He gave loans to people for interest-free. He never charged a penny. According to the Muslim law, you cannot charge interest. And he helped people with many people that could not find houses to live in. He helped them with that. And the not just the Muslims, the non-Muslims, not just happening to the Muslims, and anyone is in need, he would go to him and he would help him.
And if I can ask for those who might be listening or viewing this program who would like to lend their support to your campaign, where can they go for more information?
I set up a web page for him on my website
center.
Called Jubilee Initiative. But if they go to Google and just punch up "Free to Fear," they can they'll find all the information and stuff that we're up to. One of the things we just "Free to Fear," free and then D H A F I R. And the other thing we've started is an operation called Operation Free to Fear that Kathy Kelly is helping us with. And that is, if you gave to Iraq, you sent money to Iraq, or you traveled to Iraq and you defied the sanctions, we're asking that you please send a letter to Judge Mardew highlighting that. Judge Mardew is the one that is overseeing the case. And CC a copy to me and to your local paper as a letter to the editor, and one here, Syracuse. So we are hoping that will help, again, raise more awareness about Dr. DePere's plight.
Well, I want to thank all of our guests who joined us, Mohammed Carter, friend and supporter of Dr. Rafil Darfir, Mattis Center, Syracuse community organizer who's launched a campaign to free him, and Kathy Kelly, founder of Voices in the Wilderness. And we'll be continuing to follow up and keep tabs on this case. We move now to our next segment. A new federal study has concluded that children attending charter schools score lower on standardized tests than students at regular public schools. This, according to an article in the New York Times earlier this week. According to the Times, the Bush administration buried the federal study, and the Education Department released it without any public announcement. The results offer the first nationally representative comparison of children attending both types of schools. The result is a major setback for the Bush administration and casts doubt on a central provision of the No Child Left Behind Act, which encourages states to hand over failing schools to commercial companies and nonprofit community groups that want to run them as charter schools. Charters are self-governing public schools, often run by these companies and nonprofits, and they operate outside the authority of local school boards. Charters are expected to grow exponentially under the No Child Left Behind Act, as thousands of public schools are identified for possible closing because of poor test scores. We're going to have a debate on this issue today. We're joined by Bob Peterson, the editor of Rethinking Schools magazine. He's a fifth grade public school teacher in Milwaukee, where he has taught for 24 years, and also by Justin Torres, the research director for the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation in Washington, D.C. I want to welcome you both to Democracy Now! And I'd like to start with Bob Peterson. Your reaction to the report this week in the New York Times.
Yes, thank you very much. I think, first of all, I just have to say that test scores are regularly misused in labeling public schools. I wouldn't overstate the significance of this set of data, but what the data really show is that many students, especially urban students of color, have serious learning issues. And while charters may have a limited place in school reform efforts, the real question is how to protect and improve the public education system for all kids and not create escape valves for a lucky few. That, you know, people have promoted charters as a panacea, as a step toward, as a panacea for solving our problems in the public schools. But unfortunately, with the pushing of them through the No Child Left Behind Act, as you mentioned, I really view it as a step towards privatization that will take resources and funds away from the schools that need them most. And so I think this study is a real warning, a real call for policymakers and educational activists to say, wait a minute, these charter schools aren't all that they're alleged to be.
Justin Torres, research director for the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, which has been supporting the development and increasing of charter schools. Your reaction to the New York Times report?
Well, thanks for having me. I think there is a great deal of context that is left out of that New York Times article, which was based on an American Federation of Teachers analysis of some of the NAEP data. One of the points that really goes unstated is that the AFT was not comparing apples to apples. It is not fair, really, to compare charter students to the general run of public school students. These are students who...
And when you mentioned the AFT, that's the American Federation of Teachers, which helped to do some of the initial research for the New York Times article, right?
Yes, it did. It provided the analysis of the NAEP data. The... charter school students, in almost every case, are students who are starting behind the eight ball educationally and academically. And they are in charter schools in every case because their parents have chosen to have them there. And, you know, a student who's being well served by their regular district public school does not choose to attend a charter school. So I don't think that this study was really comparing apples to apples. And when you begin to factor in some of the distinctions in income, in race, in special education status and whatnot, the difference between charter school students and public school students actually begins to become statistically insignificant. So I think that's an important piece of context missing here.
But that's actually not the case. I mean, if you look at the data from that's accumulated by the AFT, although originally collected by the NAEP, they look at, they compare central city locations, they compare free and reduced lunch eligibility, that is income, and they found significant changes. The one place they didn't was on the issue of minority students, you're right, but I don't think, I've seen a certain opinion pieces in the recently in the press putting this claim out there that, you know, as if the charter school students are being compared with, say, white suburban, you know, students from a middle class background. That's just not the case. I mean, and this is only one of several studies that show at best charter school students' achievement is maybe the same as public school students. It's not worse. I mean, you have people as recently as yesterday in the New York Post with Chester Finn saying that there's no statistically significant difference between performance of kids in charter schools and traditional public schools. Well, keep in mind that the people who promoted charter schools originally claimed that this was going to be a huge innovation, that kids were going to make great strides and improve over the public schools. If the best defense of school reform can be, well, it's not any statistically different than the current system that you're trying to reform, to me, that shows that it's really not that significant of school reform. And don't get me wrong, I think some charter schools are fine. One of my colleagues, who is on the editorial board of Rethinking Schools, is starting a charter school here in Milwaukee. The problem I have is when people make this claim that charter schools are going to be the silver bullet of school reform, when we know that it's much more complex issues of school funding, of quality curriculum, of quality teachers, and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, the NCLB provisions within around charter schools and private management of public schools don't take into account these deep issues that we as a society must confront if we're going to solve our schools' problems.
I'd like to ask Justin Torres, one of the issues raised clearly in relationship to charter schools is the issue of accountability, that public schools, obviously with school boards, the school boards have to be responsive to voters or to the people who appointed them in terms of the performance of schools. But with the charter schools, you have a different situation. For instance, the LA Times reported on this week that one of the largest operators of charter schools in California shut its doors last week, leaving 10,000 students scrambling to be able to find classrooms to go into just a couple of weeks before the new school year. And this issue of accountability of charter schools obviously will grow as the number of these charter schools increases.
Well, of course it will. And, you know, on the point of accountability, I'd just like to make one point, which is that charter schools are accountable to charter school sponsors, to local districts if they act as the sponsor, to the state if they act as the sponsor. They are accountable for all of the requirements under No Child Left Behind in terms of testing and AYP. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the fact that a charter school is closed, while not not thrilling to me as a charter school supporter, is a sign of the accountability that's built into the system. The charter school movement is willing to make the tough decision that some schools have to close because they are not meeting expectations. We have never seen that similar willingness in the traditional district public school system. One of the things that charter schools
but
are willing
just
to do
just to interrupt you for a second. Just to interrupt you for a second on that. But when these in California, when these schools close, somebody has to educate these 10,000 kids that suddenly have no school to go to. So obviously, in a public school situation, you'd never have a situation where the public school would just shut its doors and tell kids, "Well, go and find another school to go to."
We had the case here with the voucher schools in Milwaukee, which is an extreme case of charter schoolism, really, with actually some schools shutting their doors in the middle of the school year.
There's absolutely no doubt that in various areas of the charter school movement, among various charter schools, there have been problems. I don't think that any reasonable observer of the charter school movement or any reasonable advocate of charter schools would deny that. There's absolutely no doubt. What I'm suggesting, though, is that when you have an accountability system and you demand that that schools be accountable, when schools are held accountable, to then suggest that the entire system is a failure because it worked the way it should have is really unfair and, I think, demonstrative of an agenda and not of a real desire to provide accountability into the charter school system. On another point that I'd just like to make, concerning some of the comments earlier, I really do think it's important to keep in mind that the real comparison that needs to be made between charter school students and traditional district students is not in terms of a statistical snapshot of where they are now. We need to find a way to show the value-added gains that charter schools have provided over the past 3, 5, 10 years, something like that. That was not part of the NAEP data that came out just a couple of days ago, and that's really sort of the whole point, is our charter schools getting students up to speed faster than they had been getting up to speed in the schools that they left.
Bob Peterson, I'd like to ask you about that. On the one hand, this was a snapshot of one set of test scores, and the supporters of charter schools are saying, well, we don't know what where these students were when they started in charter schools, therefore there's no way to judge whether there's been significant improvement or not. And also the issue of, well, is one standardized test the measure of the quality of education that students are getting?
This was a snapshot, and what's interesting is various snapshots done by the UCLA, by Western Michigan University, by various groups, research institutions, have found similar data that show that there has not been a significant difference between regular traditional educated students and the charter school students. I'm the first, though, to agree that we need a much more in-depth evaluation program, an assessment program of charter schools, of voucher schools, of public schools that don't rely on snapshot data. I'm a little concerned with people who promote the value-added approach. This is like the idea of testing kids all the time to see how they grow incrementally, because what I have seen as a teacher in my 24 years of teaching with inner-city kids is that to the degree that districts want to do that, the curriculum becomes very oriented towards teaching to the test. Towards very narrow conception of education where students regurgitate facts, very basic skills, but aren't challenged to think critically about what's going on in the world, aren't asked to really examine issues of social issues or even examine feelings and how they compare literature with what's going on, and it's a straitjacketing of the curriculum. And I think, quite frankly, if if charter schools are tested like that or if public schools are tested like that, it's going to have a negative impact on the quality of education. We might get a lot more data so policy wonks can, you know, debate this back and forth, but I know as a teacher what's really needed are well-funded public schools, whether they be public charter schools or regular public schools, high-quality teachers, good multicultural, anti-racist curriculum, and quality early childhood programs, all those things, none of which the charter school panacea, silver bullet agenda speaks to. And so it's not that I'm, as I said, opposed to charter schools per se, and it's not that I put all my eggs in a testing basket, but let's talk about what is really needed to help these kids in our urban and rural settings.
Well, if I can just bring in Justin Torres for one final comment, we've got about 30 seconds. Mr. Torres, the issue of the standardized testing, some of the very people who have been proposing the expansion of charter schools point to public schools and their failures on standardized tests, but now they're raising questions that these single standardized tests should not be used solely to judge the performance of charter schools. What's your response to the issue of standardized testing as a means of seeing how well these schools are doing?
Well, I mean, I think that's exactly right. You need to test over time. You need to test for value-added gains to see whether students are learning. I think this notion of the narrowing of the curriculum and teaching to the test is one of the great canards of our time, to be perfectly honest. In no other sector do we determine that assessment of the product is essentially insignificant. And more to the point, the average African-American 12th grade male reads at an 8th grade level in this country. This is a scandal. It's a disaster. And I think that the time has come for some new approaches. New approaches. We've had 30 years of progressive child-centered education, and it's failed.
Well, you're not going to prove that situation by testing them.
On that note, we're going to have to end this debate, but certainly the debate will not end here. A new school year is opening soon, and the controversy will continue. I want to thank both of you for being with us. Bob Peterson, editor of Rethinking Schools magazine, and Justin Torres, research director for the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Doctors who treat African-American patients are less likely to be board certified and less able to refer patients to specialists than doctors who treat white patients. This, according to a study published on August 5th in the New England Journal of Medicine, entitled Primary Care Physicians Who Treat Blacks and Whites. The study used Medicare data from a survey of doctors who treat patients 65 years and older. It found that geography may be a factor because physicians in largely black neighborhoods say they have trouble providing quality care. We're joined now by the lead author of the study, Dr. Peter Bach, who is a pulmonologist and internal medicine doctor at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center with expertise in quality of care and epidemiological research methods. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about the study and what you found?
Well, you've done a good summary. The purpose of the study was to determine first whether or not black and white Medicare patients were going to the same doctors, or if rather black and white patients mostly went to different doctors. And if the second situation was present, then the question was whether or not the doctors that blacks went relative to the ones that doctors at whites went to could provide the same quality of care. As you mentioned, the study was based on a survey of physicians. And in that survey, the doctors were asked, are you able to provide certain things for your patients, including access to specialists, access to imaging tests or radiology tests like CAT scans and MRIs, access to what's referred to as elective admission to the hospital, where a doctor would bring a patient into the hospital to figure out what is going on with them, even though it's not an emergency, and other things like that. And what we found was, first of all, black and white patients really don't go to the same doctors. Most of the care provided to black patients is provided by a very small number of primary care physicians. About 20% of all U.S. primary care physicians provide about 80% of the care to black patients, while most of the care for white patients occurs with other physicians. And then we observed that of the physicians treating blacks and whites, there were differences, not only, as you mentioned, in the physician's rate of board certification. Physicians treating black Americans are less likely to be board certified than those treating whites, but also that the physicians treating blacks were more likely to say they couldn't provide access to particular resources for their patients. Now, the reason we pursued this study was we're trying to understand why it is that for essentially all diseases, blacks in the United States are diagnosed later, or in other words, the diseases are more advanced and harder to treat, and also, after they're diagnosed with diseases, they receive less good treatment and have worse outcomes. Our hypothesis was that one of the things happening is that when a black patient has, let's say, a nonspecific symptom or sign, they feel sick, put simply, and go to the doctor, they're more likely to see a doctor who either doesn't have the resources or doesn't have access to the tests or the admissions to hospitals or other sorts of things that are needed to rapidly and thoroughly evaluate what is causing that patient to not feel well. And when what is going on there is something serious, heart disease or cancer, there is delay for black patients relative to whites, where whites are more likely to go to physicians who do have access to those resources.
Now, why would that be? If your study is based largely on Medicare data, and Medicare is universal, obviously, for people over 65, then would this be that the white patients tend to have additional insurance that provides greater opportunities for more doctors to service them? Or, you know, have you been able to analyze why you think this is happening?
We can't tell from the study exactly why it is that physicians are telling us they face these obstacles. And remember that in this survey, we asked the physicians about all of their patients, not just their Medicare patients, but only studied their Medicare patients because we had high-quality data on where those patients go and where they receive their care. But the issue of why the physicians can't access or face obstacles to accessing these resources is probably quite a bit more complicated than the patient's insurance alone. There has to be the local availability of these facilities. If a patient has an insurance card but there is no radiology facility nearby, that insurance card doesn't do them that much good. And similarly, if there aren't a lot of high-quality specialists in the area, or if those high-quality specialists are overworked, it could be equally hard for those physicians to obtain access to those specialists for their patients in those communities, even though the patients have insurance.
Well, we're also joined on the phone by Dr. Winston Price, who's the president of the National Medical Association, which represents African-American physicians around the country. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Dr. Price, your reaction to the study by Dr. Peter Bach and the disparities in medical treatment to African Americans?
Well, let me preface my comments by thanking Dr. Bach for bringing these things to the surface, but caution the conclusions in the study, as Dr. Bach clearly pointed out, there are much more complex issues that need to be gleaned from why there are disparities in the healthcare outcomes. That said, I think it's important to recognize that the study pointed out that a minority of physicians are taking care of the majority of Medicare patients. But if you think of the analogy of firemen running into a burning building, these minority of physicians are carrying their stethoscopes and whatever intellectual resources they have to put out fires of disease. They are the troopers who are going into these communities where there are patients of need. It's the system's responsibility to make sure the water's turned on. Otherwise, they cannot provide the quality of care that's necessary for these complex patients. The communities where the study points out that the physicians are having difficulties taking care of these patients are the communities where safety net hospitals and lack of specialists are paramount. And the more complex the patient, the more chronic their disease, the more it's necessary to have the backup facilities, the radiology centers, the pharmacies with adequate stocks of medications to support the complex polymorphic disease that these individuals have. And those systems are just not in place in those communities. So it's not surprising to me that these were the results of this particular survey. We already know from the Institute of Medicine report that was presented more than 2 years ago that the quality of care provided to minorities across the country are not to the same level of care that are provided to white patients. And this is because of a complex issue of racism in medicine, as well as issues with respect to access and availability. And that needs to change if we're going to see a change in the outcomes.
Well, what about this issue of access and availability in terms of the backup systems, the testing systems, the hospitals, and so forth to black and white patients? I would assume that since most hospitals these days need patients to fill their beds, that even those institutions that historically have not reached out to service black or minority communities would want to do that these days. But yet there still is apparently an enormous problem in terms of access. I'd like to ask Dr. Bach first and Dr. Price on that issue.
I think it's not clear, certainly from our study, to what extent the obstacles that the physicians face in referring their patients are directly result of, let's say, not enough hospital beds in the neighborhoods, as opposed to other sorts of obstacles they may face. It's difficult, it's an ordeal to get admitting privileges, for example, for a doctor practicing in the community, to get admitting privileges to a particular hospital. Each set of admitting privileges to each hospital requires additional work and maintenance, and it's not always a guarantee. And it's possible that in communities, even if there are just as many hospital beds, if there are smaller hospitals or ones where it is harder to get admitting privileges, that these physicians may face additional obstacles that the physicians treating white patients are not facing. And it may be more complicated than simply a number of hospital beds in the neighborhood or something like that.
Dr. Price, what about this issue of admitting privileges? Do your members, African-American doctors, tell you that they have more difficulty getting admitting privileges to major hospitals?
Well, I mean, those are two separate issues. I think across the board, the bias that is experienced by African-American and Latino physicians is paramount, is well documented, and is part of the problem with respect to the disparities that we see in the numbers and the diversity within the healthcare system. That said, I think one of the things I did not see in this particular study is it gave a sense of the level of frustration that the physicians taking care of these Medicare patients, both black and white physicians, the frustration they had in trying to deliver care and in trying to get the patients admitted. But the study did not detail, the data may be there, but it did not detail the degree to which these physicians attempted to admit patients. And so what would be important as well is not only a level of frustration, but a documentation of an attempt by one of these physicians to admit a patient, and contrast that to a white physician treating a patient with similarly complex disease with a similar presentation at the same time under the same circumstances. In the JAMA article looking at cardiac disease, it was pointed out in that study that black females seeking advanced cardiac diagnostic studies with equal access and equal levels of insurance got differential care. And
well,
so it
let me ask you, Dr.
level of racism within healthcare.
Dr. Winston, let me ask you, the federal government has set a goal of by 2010 eliminating racial disparities in healthcare. Your association has some recommendations in terms of what might be able to be done to provide equal access and equal care?
Well, with respect to this particular study, I think what was pointed out and what our recommendations are is that there needs to be greater attention given to improving the access to quality health care for black patients. The circumstances under which physicians serving black Medicare patients are stressful. We know that. They usually are paid less. They usually have to work longer hours, and they usually have limited resources in terms of support services in the community, as Dr. Bach mentioned, to do the adequate diagnosis and to find specialists in the community to make those referrals. Now, these physicians have to jump these hurdles. They don't get paid as well. They don't get paid as frequently because of encumbrances within the Medicare payment system. And so the recommendations are that there needs to be improved resources in those communities, particularly the safety net hospitals.
And Dr. Bach, we have about 30 seconds. Your recommendations about what might be done to equalize the treatment?
Well, I have to say I concur with Dr. Price and his recommendations. I want to clarify a small point so your readers know what our study found. Although it's true that black and minority physicians provide a larger percentage of care to black patients than they do to white patients, only a minority of the physicians in our study, only about 1 in 5 of those treating black patients were actually black physicians. And so I don't want your readers to mistake a study that is about the care of black patients and assume that what we're talking about is therefore black physicians treating black patients. They comprise an important but a small segment of all the care provided to those patients.
All right. Well,
no,
I'd like to
I'd
like to thank both of you for being with us today. Dr. Peter Bach, lead author of the study "Primary Care Physicians Who Treat Blacks and Whites," published in this month in the New England Journal of Medicine, and Dr. Winston Price, president of the National Medical Association. And that does it for today's show. For a copy of today's program, call 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. Amy will be in Eureka, California tomorrow to benefit for KMUD and KHSU at the Eureka Municipal Authority on 12th and F Street. On Sunday, she'll be in Hopeland, California. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qaddous, Anna Nagera, Elizabeth Presnell, Geiser, John Hamilton. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.